Sidebar with body language and behavioral expert Scott Rouse.
Scott, how you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you holding up?
You tell me.
sounds like you're busy over there.
We're busy in Quebec. I'm busy trying not to lose my mind. I'm busy trying to make a difference in a manner that is not counterproductive. And above all else, I'm trying to maintain optimism for a better future and not a full-blown permanent police state that Canada quickly seems to be coming.
Wow, very well said.
But I'm sure you can probably say this is a joke and you must get it all the time. You can probably read in more to my own outward conduct than I can read into myself, although I'm sufficiently insightful as to my own behavior and so on. Scott, explain to the audience who you are before we even get into this. Like, who are you? What do you do? And then I'm diving deep into your childhood.
Okay. Well, I'm a body language expert and analyst, and I train law enforcement and the military in interrogation and body language, in a nutshell.
Okay. And now you've been doing this for how long?
Oh, Lord. Probably full on since the early 2000s. And before that, it wasn't a hobby or anything. I was doing that as well, but I was also in the music business. I was a record producer.
Okay. So I was listening to Eric Hunley, one of the earlier podcasts, and I know all of this stuff already, and I know the questions I have, but let's just go right back to the very, very beginning. The question I always love, how many siblings do you have? Where were you born and what was your childhood like?
I have two. I have an older sister, Ellen, and younger brother, Mitch. And Ellen lives in Knoxville. My brother lives in Los Angeles. And so what was the question about being a kid?
Well, so like where were you born? You're born in Kentucky, from what I understand?
Knoxville, Tennessee. But we lived in Kentucky for a while. Yeah, we lived in Kentucky for a while. And then was raised in Knoxville and Oak Ridge. My dad was in the Air Force. So we lived on an Air Force base for a while when I was a little kid. But then we moved to Oak Ridge, to make a long story short.
Okay, so now hold on a second. I've always found this fascinating. You lived on a military facility.
Mm-hmm.
What is that like for someone who's never experienced it, has no idea what it even looks like? What is that like?
Well, I was a little kid. I was 3 years old, 3 or 4 years old when we were there. Like, and I think we were there 2 or 3 years. And my father was a flight surgeon. He's a major in the Air Force. And that we lived on the base. And I just remember it being fun because we lived in the section where everybody was. So everybody, you could talk to these people you didn't know, and everybody looked the same. You know, I really liked it. From what I remember of it, it was really fun. I really enjoyed it.
And after your dad leaves the military, goes into private practice?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's when we moved to Louisa, Kentucky, tiny little town in eastern Kentucky. Wonderful. Some of the most wonderful years of my life there. And it was kind of like being from Mayberry, because everybody knew everybody. The town wasn't very big at all. You could literally let your kids walk downtown, which was just a few blocks away. The school was next door to us, the grade school. And then my dad was at the hospital, which is like two big houses connected together. And so he was a surgeon there at the hospital. And at one point he was the only doctor in the whole town. So that's where we were. That's where we lived. So, and everybody knew everybody well.
Yeah. Those must've been different times, at least when they knew everybody. And I suspect they liked everybody, as opposed to now. If you do know everybody, you probably don't like everybody. And you definitely, in most places, don't know everybody. The podcast with Eric, you said that you got the early seed of reading people from your dad and from his practice.
Yep. Oh yeah. When I was, my mom would take us to go have lunch with my dad at the hospital, you know, a couple of times a week sometimes, cause it was just right, literally down the street. And my sister was in school. She was in, I guess, the third grade. And I must've been in the first grade. My brother wasn't in school yet. So she would come over and get us, and we'd walk down and have lunch with my dad, and we'd have lunch in his office. And you could see out into what was the lobby of his office, which is this big room. And we would see these people sitting out there as we were eating, you know? And one day I looked out there and I saw these two guys I knew, and that from my class, Robert Bellamy and Billy Elkins. And I was looking at him. What are Billy and Robert doing here? What's wrong with them? My dad said, well, let's get a look. So he looked out there at him and said, well, Robert has an earache. And so he's going to have a problem with his ear. And then Billy, he isn't sick. There's nothing wrong with him. He's pretending he's sick. Then I said, you know, however you said he's a kid, you know, first and second grade. I said, how do you know that? He said, well, let's take a look at Robert. We looked at Robert, and he said, now let's look at his mom first. And I said, okay. So his mom looks like she hasn't had much sleep. And usually when we see her, her hair's done really nicely and she's got her makeup on and she's smiling and she seems to be in a good mood. And I said, yeah. She said, now let's look at Robert. We looked at Robert. He said, see how he's got his hand on his ear? The basics. And I said, yeah. And he's leaned up against his mother. And I said, yeah. And he said, that lets me know his ear hurts. And his mother's been up all night with him. And I thought, oh, that's magic. And I said, well, what about Billy? And he said, well, let's look at Billy. He said, well, look at his mom. And we looked at his mom. He said, see how she looks really pretty and her hair is done and she has her makeup on and everything. And I said, yeah. And he said, well, that tells me she got up this morning and got ready to go. I said, to come down here. I said, great. And he said, now let's look at Billy. So we looked over at Billy. And Billy was a buddy of mine. He hung out at our house and stuff all the time. We looked at him and he said, now, what's he doing? And so he's reading, he's looking at a magazine. And it was like highlights or one of those things that you get at the dentist in the doctor's office. He said, see how his legs are dangling and going like that? And I said, yeah. And he said, and you see how he's just looking and he's got that, his eyebrows are up as he's looking at the thing. And I said, yeah. He said, now in a minute, what he's going to do is his mother's going to say something to him. And when she does, his eyebrows are going to go down. His head's going to turn sideways. And he's going to look up at her and he's going to have a sad face. And when he does, his mother will say something to him. He'll say something to her and she'll pat him on the shoulder, like put her arm on and pat him on the shoulder. Then he'll go back down. His eyebrows will go up and he'll start reading that magazine. And I said, okay, well, I'm waiting for this. Within 2 minutes, that happened. And I thought, this guy's magic. And I was like, what, how do you know that? And he said, well, you have to know how people react, what they're feeling. You got to be able to tell how they're feeling when they come in so you're here to help them, you know? And I said, okay. So from then on, I was totally into the way people acted, the way their demeanor and especially what they were going to do next. I think that's what triggered the what's going to happen next with Billy, because he told me what he was going to do before he did it. Not just a couple of seconds, but, you know, 2 or 3 minutes before. Fascinated with that. So from then on, I got my first body language book from my dad gave me. It was called Body Language.
Scott, just before you do that, I'm going to bring Robert in because I see he's in there now.
Oh, okay, good.
And I don't want to surprise him by bringing him in when he doesn't know it yet. Robert.
Okay. There he is. The stream.
Yeah. In Chattanooga. I didn't realize I was kind of an hour. I forgot the hour gap that I lose an hour going from Nashville. I was in Scott's neighborhood. I was up in
Frank. Why didn't you call me?
Yeah, well, I flew in, gave a speech, then drove down. My kid picked me up and we drove down to Chattanooga and thought I'd be arriving here at 6 p.m. Eastern time and got here at 7 p.m. Eastern time.
My wife's in Chattanooga right now.
Oh, really?
So I got in the same town. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Is it doing something in particular or no?
Oh, she's staying. Her best friend lives there. One of her best friends lives there. And she's they're getting ready to go out of town. She's going to be watching the dogs.
Uh-huh.
Robert, your backdrop is a fake backdrop, right?
Yes, of course. Yes.
I'm trying to figure out how on earth an angle could get that wide of an angle without distorting you in this.
Yes, okay. Exactly. Yeah, it's a green screen.
Very cool. So, Robert, you heard the intro. I mean, the story about how Scott got into it, it's amazing. What I love the most about this is you had a very good relationship with your father, right, Scott?
Mm-hmm. And my mom. Yeah, great one. Really lucky. Really lucky.
Now, where did you grow up?
In Oak Ridge, Tennessee. But we're talking about when I was a little kid, we lived in Louisa, Kentucky, tiny little town up in the mountains of Kentucky.
So, okay, now we're going to skip ahead. So you have this experience, which is, it's amazing the detail that you remembered in to indicate what a mark it left on your life. The next steps are what now? Because you said you went into music. Like, where do you go into music? And then I also have to ask you about your voice, because were you a singer or did you have any voice play in the music industry?
Oh, okay. Well, my dad was also a musician and he was a writer and a guitar player. And he was like a session guy in Nashville. So when he was going to medical school, before we had moved to Louisa, he hung out at nighttime in the studios and worked there, hung out with, musicians and writers and those kinds of things. Until my mom said, look, man, she threatened to leave him. He came home one night in the car was all packed and I think she was pregnant with me and had my sister in the car and said, look, you got to make a decision, man. You're going to be either be a musician or a doctor. Pick the one you want, but if you can't pick it, I'm going to my mom's. So he chose doctor, and that's when he became a doctor. So that's where I guess my music thing came from as well, because I grew up, we took piano lessons and stuff as little kids. And then I took guitar and sort of focused on that and grew up playing guitar, and then ended up going to Berklee College of Music in Boston. And
any instrument in particular?
Guitar.
Okay.
Mostly guitar, drums too, but mostly guitar. And then, I started hanging out with a lot of musicians there who were producers, and I was just a session guy. You know, I'd start playing, where you go play on records and stuff. So I got hired to play on a bunch of records. And then these guys who ended up being friends of mine that were producers said, hey, look, we're doing a couple of records and we want you to play on them. And I said, okay, great. So I hung around the studio and played all the guitars and stuff on these records. And so a couple of them ended up moving in with me, being my roommate. So we had a bunch of people living in our apartment, and some of those records turned out to do very well. We did, these guys did New Kids on the Block and New Edition. And those are the sort of the home base for the studio where we were, which was called Mission Control at the time, and run by some really great guys there. So it was really a great learning experience there. So that's where I learned how to produce.
Is that the Boston area? Is that where you were located?
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, and what was that? Late 70s, 80s, mid 80s?
Yeah, it was in the 80s. I moved to Nashville in 88.
So you're in Boston like the peak of Larry Bird era, Boston Celtics.
Oh my God. They'd go nuts over that guy. Lose their minds. Oh yeah, they love that guy.
Deservedly so. My father was from Rhode Island, so a huge Boston everything fan. So we grew up New England Patriots, Boston Celtics, Boston Red Sox, but Bird was the ultimate. And that era was the ultimate Boston era. So all right, so what led you to move to Nashville?
The music business was changing. So I could see there was a scene in Boston. It was getting really, it was doing well, but I could see there was a country music thing coming in, and I didn't do country. I was really into bluegrass, grew up doing that. My dad was really into all kinds of music, so he had a focus on country as well. So I was versed in it. And when I moved to Nashville, I got a gig at the Country Music Hall of Fame being a tour guide, because they didn't have to train me. So I went in and talked to him, and the lady who trained you walked me through the museum. She said, well, this is, I said, oh yeah, it's Uncle Jimmy Thompson. He's the guy in 1923, he was the first guy on the Grand Ole Opry. She said, how do you know that? I said, well, my dad's, a history buff when it comes to country music. And so she walked me through. I knew all the stuff. Well, she said, okay, you got the gig. I went into like be a janitor or something. I thought I was going to be cleaning up, but she said, okay, you can be a tour guide. I said, okay, great. So I wanted to get in there because I wanted to get in the library, where they had all the, I shouldn't be saying this on here, but I'll tell you. So I wanted to get in the music library, and I just got one of those a Sony Walkman that you could record to. You could go out of one of the record players were, because they had it's the largest country music archive in the world. And so on all my breaks from being a tour guide, I'd go down there, and they think I was just listening. I was listening to all this old stuff you can't get anymore. You can't get, because it doesn't exist outside of that library. No kidding. So it was, so every day it was a contest to see how much music I could collect from there. I wasn't selling or anything. I just wanted it so I could hear it and have it and learn from it, because I was in that business. So I wanted to learn from it. And I did. I got tons of it until I got caught one afternoon. I came in and the guy said, I won't say his name. He said, so what are you doing? And I said, just listening to it, because I go in every day and I'd ask for these really odd albums. And he said, so are you recording this? And I said, yeah. Yeah. So I said, I'll leave. I know I'm going to get canned for this. And he goes, no. He goes, just keep it to yourself. Keep it to yourself. I was like, oh, what? And he said, yeah, just be cool. And I was like, okay. So, and he goes, and we never had this talk. I said, okay. So for about another year, I kept doing that until somebody else told on me that worked there. Like, I think he's recording music. Yeah, and I was, I wasn't going to say no, because I knew that. I think everybody can tell when you're not telling the truth. So that's one of the things that bugs me. So I was like, and that's exactly what I'm doing. How long have you been doing it? I was like, for a while. How long have you been here? 2 years. How long have you been doing it? 2 years. So, it was kind of a.
No, like this is before the Napster era. The Napster era. So now, but and everyone has to be asking themselves this question, because if they're not, this is the question to ask. How do you get from the music industry into being effectively, a recognized body language behavioral expert who advises the military? Like, what's, how does that trajectory happen, and how does one lead you into the other?
Well, you sort of have to come out of the closet, is that in my case, you know, not that I ever hid it. You know, I never said I'm not into body language. I don't understand that. I'm not into interrogation, but from the people I was hanging out with and the people that I was working with, it just sort of kept leading that way. I was hanging out with cops all the time. They were like, how do I tell if somebody's getting ready to run? I was like, here's what you look for. So that's where the training stuff started, was being able to tell friends of mine, here's what you look for. So when I retired from the music business in 2011, when I became the entrepreneur in residence at the Nashville Entrepreneur Center, I said, the music business was changing. They were giving music away. And I was like, yeah, we're not going to be able to make any more money in this. And I talked to my wife. She said, yeah, go ahead and get out. So I did that and just said, okay, I'm just going to do what I want and focus on body language and behavior. And I don't care if anybody knows what I do or not. And used to, it was one of those things where I never told anybody what I worked on, what I was doing musically, because my hero was this guy named Mutt Lange. And he's like, he's the most successful record producer ever. And there's like three pictures of him. So I wanted to be that guy. And until I started working at the Entrepreneur Center, there were no pictures of me online or anything. And the first one was of me and Bootsy Collins. And when we were in Memphis one time, and then the second one was Elvis Costello and Doc Watson and me and myself, or have you said grammatically correct. And so at that point, I was like, okay, I don't care at that point. So, you know, I didn't care who knew or anything at that point.
So, yeah, because how did you get that gig? Because I think you've helped people raise, what is it, $500 million or something? I mean, it's a ridiculous sum of money. Just by helping them present and know how to, and especially, it's amazing how much the VC, the venture capital world, the investment world is all about that. If you don't convince them that you're confident in your idea, by golly, they're not going to be confident in investing in your idea. Yeah. But how did you find out about that? How did you bridge over into that?
Well, when I lived in Boston, we were all the time pitching acts. You know, you'd have a singer and you have to go pitch the act, the singer to the thing. And so watching these guys that I was hanging with and live with all the time, I knew how to do it from there and how to present something. So you sold more of the sizzle than the thing itself. And my dad was into that. So another thing my dad, you know, cultured into me or put into me was how to sell something. So the skills of learning how to talk to someone to get them interested in what you have to sell, and then doing the things body language wise to get them interested in it and stay interested in it and keep their attention, sort of some of the stuff I'm doing now, then there are specific things you can do. And there's a specific protocol if you follow it. I say that you really have a really good chance of getting funded. Everybody I've worked with, every person I've worked with, from man to child to woman to whatever, they've all been funded since 2011, every one of them. And if it's not for their big $18 million thing for a hospital, they'll get $4 million of it. They'll get something like that. They'll get, or the thing leading up to it.
So, I mean, that's amazing, actually. And I don't think most people know that necessarily here, but you go into advising on people how to make presentations, how to be convincing, compelling, and persuasive before getting into what you're doing now.
Well, I was sort of doing this at the same time. So okay. That's where it's, you know, and the whole I've always considered myself being into body language since that day at the hospital growing up. So I've always been focused on that. And I've always just incorporated into whatever I was doing, and it helped. And I got really lucky at the Entrepreneur Center. There was a guy there named Michael Burcham, who was the CEO. And when I would tell him stuff, he would listen. He would say, oh, okay, great. Well, then you'll go do this. That'll be your job. Why don't you train these people how to do that? And I said, okay, do you have something you want to follow? I said, nope. And I said, so I can come up with my own thing. He said, yep. He said, you just started the pitch department for the EC. We call it the EC. So you're in charge of that. That's you. And I said, okay. So I started doing that and started learning. I'd gone through a thing where you go through, a buddy of mine and I were talking, and we said, we should go through the accelerator they have there. And I said, what do we do? They said, well, I've got an idea for so-and-so. We talked and came up with the idea. And I said, well, if we can settle on what the idea is, if you'll be the CEO, I'll show us how to pitch it. I'll get us in. That won't be a problem. I'll be able to get us in. He said, you think so? I said, I promise you I'll get us in. So we pitched our thing and got in. And so we got to go through the system, this thing called Jumpstart Foundry, which is great because I got to see how that worked. And then as I was going through it, could see, oh, okay. And they're teaching you how to pitch, but it wasn't quite where it should be. So from then adding the body language skill set to that and training these people full on. I mean, giving them all of it specifically for that made all the difference in the world. All the contests that people entered, when they would enter a contest, they'd win. We had three people in a contest once, and Michael Burcham came to me and he said, okay, we got three people in this contest. And I said, well, who do you want to win? He said, what do you mean? He said, any of them. I said, well, we need to know who's first, second, and third. I'd like to try that. And so to make a long story short, I trained him so that one came in first, one came in second, one came in third, and beat all the other people. So that was, for me, it wasn't that big a deal to anybody else, but for me, it was a big deal because I was like, wow, this, you know, every time something like that happens, you go, it does work. It's one of those, you know.
And what was the biggest thing you found in terms of what skill set people lacked that were, you know, in going into this such that they really needed and benefited from professional training? Where was the original mismatch?
Was having a misunderstanding about what they were seeing from people. The biggest thing that, and I did a study on this, and I would do videos of this, and I've got a whole big thing I'm putting together still for that, was when someone is pitching, they're under the impression if someone's doing this, if they're going, while they're watching them, they think that person's into what they're doing. And we would pitch these people would pitch their, we train them to pitch to 500 to 1,000 people at this thing. It would all be investors came from all around the world to this thing in Nashville, and they would pitch these people, and a lot of people would get their deals from that. But what they didn't understand was the person who was sitting there looking at him and smiling like that, they didn't care about investing. They weren't there. What you want is someone who looks like what you think they look like when they're turned off. Because when they're up in their head thinking and they're running numbers and stuff, they'll start doing things where that shows you they're having internal dialogue. So when they shut off, they'll start this. They'll sit back a little bit. They'll cross their legs. They'll look at you like you're full of it. And they'll do this, all kinds of things that tell you that they're not into what you have to say and they're not interested. Those are the people that invest because they're the ones that are thinking about what you're saying. That's what you want. So people that would focus on smiling people and all that, they did okay. But as soon as you go from focused on the people who are smiling to the people looking at you like this, because they're thinking, I've got to take this home and tell my wife we're putting $1.2 million in this, or I've got to go back to the company and tell the guy that's in charge or the woman that's in charge, we're putting $3 million in this. You know, are they going to fire me? Is this going to work? How's it going to look in 3 years, 5 years, 10 years? Are we going to get our money back? Can I believe this person? Do I trust this person? Can they trust it? So they start going inward.
Scott, are you doing this at the time you're doing this? Are you doing this on your own or do you have one employer with multiple clients or is it a consulting firm type thing?
Well, it was at the Entrepreneur Center. At the Entrepreneur Center, anybody could come in. And they would have, you could be the person at the sanitation department and come in and say, I've got an idea for this. And we sit with you and say, it was big. So you had a group of people sit with you. Okay, you might be able to do this. This is how it could help you. Or you can do this. Or if you want to, what we'll do is we'll help fund you. We'll give you this much money to come in and get you started on that. It was brilliant. It was a great place at the time. It was just wonderful for that. And so, and then I worked there. And when I started working there, I didn't want anything for it. You know, I didn't work for anything. And I'm going to tell you this too, but then I decided I would get paid. So I worked it. Okay, let me tell you this as well. I'm writing, almost finished with this book called 30 Days of Psychopath. And it's what would happen if a psychopath were to get into that situation of a company going from nothing to being very successful. From their pitch all the way being very successful. And it was where I was going to take 30 days. And at the Entrepreneur Center, I would do everything a psychopath does, not kill anybody, nothing like that, but from a business perspective, because there are a lot of them in business, and do that. And I would take a 2 or 3 day run at it. And I would and during these things, and keep in mind, a psychopath will say anything, they'll do anything to get something for what they want. You know, so the rule was nobody got hurt. Nobody had to clean anything up. Nobody's feelings got hurt. But I would tell people stuff to get them to go tell somebody else something to get something else done. And that ran up to getting me, I was like the third or fourth highest paid person there by the time I finished my 30 days in that. And to this day, there's still a guy there that won't talk to. Every time my name comes up, he spits. That still works at the EC, hates my guts. And I've tried to talk to him and say, hey, look, man, I'm so sorry. But here's what was going on. But it still won't listen to me. I feel terrible about that. So I've got this book that I'm finishing called 30 Days of Psychopath. And what would happen if you put one, when you put one in a financial system like that?
Okay. Oh, I was going to say, yeah, you're writing a book, but there was going to say, I was going to say something. There was one story you told Eric at one point, and I thought it funny because you talk about psychopaths and, you know, who are willing to manipulate, and we're going to get into how you identify this later. You said, when you were learning the body language and you were reading all these books, there was an experience that you mentioned something about going to a grocery store, striking a conversation with someone who you didn't know, but trying to get them to believe that you knew them, and the cues that you would pick up on, like looking at something on their bag, a sticker, oh, yeah, or what are those things called, to create some form of a semblance of memory, and yeah, then to see their reaction so you could read what they did. So explain the exercise to anybody who might think that's totally whack, okay, to do that. And what was the purpose and what did it teach you?
Okay. Well, keep in mind, I train people to do that when that work for the government. So sometimes you have to, I can't tell you everything, but I'll tell you, I'll get right up next to the things I can't tell you. But there was a guy in the grocery store and I decided I was going to go. It's when you start getting into body language, two things happen. There's a section where you think you know everything about human behavior and you become a person who thinks an absolutist, where you think just because somebody does that, it means they're lying. Or you think they do something across their arms, it means this thing every time you see it. Once you get past that and realize humans are all humans and we're all different and all behave differently, things change. Then when you get into psychopathy, you think everybody's a psychopath for about 4 years. You start thinking about the guy that sat behind you in the eighth grade. That guy must have been a psychopath. I knew he was a psychopath. I knew it. When it's not the case. So in this case, I decided I need to start learning about making someone believe I already knew him. So when you get in a position, so when you're in a situation where you have to get that person to believe that you're supposed to be there, everything is fine. Although they've never seen you before, they need to have the impression they've met you before and feel guilty for not knowing you. So there's a protocol you follow for that as well. So one of the things in that situation, and I think I know what you're talking about, the guy had a book bag and he had a certain kind of shoes. And of course he had something on his shirt and he had a ring that I recognized from a fraternity. And I went up, started talking to him without saying his name, without pretending I knew his name. I said, dude, what are you doing? I haven't seen you in ever. And you talk for a while and you sort of plant these things in them where they may have seen you, because you'll know you've seen them from, let's say it was track shoes or something like that, or basketball. I've seen you playing basketball or whatever. And this guy, I forget what was, he had a hat on. I forgot what was on his hat. But I could, just by looking at somebody, it's that old Sherlock Holmes thing where he knows everything about you. But it's sort of like that type of thing. But I've never been able to do it like that at all. But you just grab these pieces of information and you feed it to them so they believe that you are familiar with them already. And you talk to them. And once you get them to talk a little bit, you can see where they're from. You can check their vernacular, how smart they are, how they structure their sentences, if they've been to school, if they are in school, how long have they been there? Are they in more of an analytical situation or more in a creative situation, by the terms and words they use? And then you can go from there. It takes a while to teach you how to do that. But once you get good at it, you'll be able, you can go in and just grab all that stuff, mostly from what you see at first. But then when you start talking, everybody gives you, they'll tell you anything. Because like Bevo, we were talking one time and you were telling me about the, it was a kid from, you live in Quebec. Who's the kid that lives near where you live? And it's stuff like that. And you start, and they start thinking, well, I've got to come up with something because I'm uncomfortable. I've got to do. So you start thinking, what did I tell them this?
I thought you were being serious, and I'm starting to think of, what are you talking about?
You're an attorney, so dude, I don't know what you're talking about. So you two wouldn't have a problem with that. I would never do it to you two. But if you don't have somebody, you can say, I know you from, and you start throwing things out. It's like a shotgun blast. It's like people who say they talk to the dead. It's that kind of thing. You know, the old the Barnum statements, and you can say certain things and just throw a shotgun blast of stuff out there and they'll say something near it and you latch onto that. You know, I see someone in your past has passed away. It's a man, it's an older man. Yeah. It's probably your grandfather, you know? So you go down once you understand how those things work, then you can pretty much talk to anybody and you can reel that back. So you can meet pretty much anybody and make them feel comfortable with meeting you, even though you're not trying to get all that information from them. Once you hear a couple of things, you know what to zoom in on and say, okay, I can talk to them about the way things look because of the things they're saying, or they're into music by the way they're describing things, or they're into the way things feel they're the kinetic person by talking about things, how things feel to them, those kind of things. So you can make friends quickly and build relationships by just listening to people. how they talk and just sort of repeating that back to them. Once you know where they're coming from, it's easy to deal with them and talk to them. So, and that's just a skill you got to, that's years and years and years and years of doing that.
Yeah. I mean, no question. Or you can freak them out like I did a Russian oligarch. So the, who I didn't speak any Russian at all. However, I was just sort of mirroring his body language, behavior, and sort of detecting little things here or there just from a lifetime of doing that personally and then professionally. I didn't have the intelligible language that you have and that others have, nor anywhere near the skill set. But I just had just enough of it to terrorize the poor guy. He thought for sure I secretly knew Russian and that I was secretly interrogating him and maybe I worked for Putin. He had his whole conspiracy theory.
Wow.
Lots of different places. I mean, he was trying to hit on the girl I was with and set up a whole like thing inside of a Russian oligarch's. One of the old Russian czar's houses had like a private pianist and the whole nine yards. So his plan wasn't going the way he thought. And then he had me interpreting him in certain ways that sort of freaked him out and spooked him out. Right. So it was a different reaction to that kind of body language. But you've also talked about how another way you incorporated it in was in the music business, in the sense of doing deals and negotiations. Could you describe how it was useful in that setting as well?
Yeah. If you had an act, like in the 80s, if you had acts, people would say, if you had a singer that sang some kind of specific, genre, and then they, in their band, they had this, this, and this. Well, what they would do is, if one of them was hitting really hard, they'd go out and, in other words, not all the time, but someone would see ones that are doing great, and they would collect those acts so they wouldn't interfere with the ones they already had going. So they would give them a deal, and they'd make a record, and nothing would ever happen. You never hear from them.
And bury them.
So watching, being able to pay attention to who was doing that to you was very important, because you could tell who's going to sign your act if they're really interested in it. If they weren't doing this all the time, like we talked about before, if they started going, let me see how this works. So there's two of you that do this and one of that. And if you don't see those things in those meetings at all, nobody's thinking about it. They're just there to be nice to you and see how quick they can get you off the street. In other words, it's not very popular. It doesn't happen all the time, but it was happening back then. So that's one example of just knowing who you're dealing with. Because if you've got somebody who's worked so long on their career, you don't want somebody to just put you aside for no reason, just to benefit them and not help you. So that used to make me mad when I see that.
Well, the other thing there in that capacity is the degree to which, as you mentioned, the absolute is a big problem that people have in body language. Yeah. The other is the extraordinary amount of projection that people have. I mean, I've seen it in the lawyer context, but we're seeing it sort of in the Chauvin trial, where these jurors are coming in interpreting Derek Chauvin's physical reactions as having these great meanings when all they could see like were his eyes. I mean, they're not interpreting anything else. They're like, oh, I knew he had no remorse. I knew, I could tell midway through when he was getting upset and agitated. I was like, they're not describing anything that actually represents that. What is it like in going into it? How did you avoid some of that? And in training people now, how do you disabuse them of a lot of their mythical abilities to read into things that are often their own projection?
Even though we know that just cross your arms doesn't mean anything, and it could be the most wonderful thing in the world because they're listening going, oh, this is great. They're hugging themselves going, this is awesome. You just explain, don't do it. There's a lot of things you don't want to do because it might trigger that person to go, oh, they're not listening to you. They're not even want to have to say they're being aggressive. So there's tons of things you can do to show that you're not being aggressive. And one of them is like when I bring my arms back and push my face forward like that, I'm saying, here, you can hit me. We're on video, so it doesn't matter. But as I'm talking to someone, I could do something like that and be more that way. You don't want police officers to do that because you don't know what the other person they're talking to is going to do. But in some cases where you're dealing with trying to knock something down, get everybody calmed down a little bit, there's specific things you can do to help that happen. From everything, the way you look and act, so that they know immediately that you're not being aggressive. Tons of things you can do, maybe that's part of the thing they're always talking about, new training. Maybe that's what they're doing. I haven't talked to anybody who's doing that yet, but they should be doing that. That would be one of the things I would suggest.
But what do you say? Say everybody thinks they're a body language expert. And I watched your TED talk where you say, like you learn from your own Frankenstein of things that you stitch together, your own experiences. But the reality is like there's good and there's bad body language reading just based on predictability and success rates. But how do you not fall into the trap of projection? I do every now and again a video where I analyze what I think someone's reactions are, I can probably appreciate that the majority of the time I'm projecting any number of my own, either my own fears, my own biases, or my own conditioning. But it's, you know, it's only my opinion. How do you avoid that tainting your own analysis of someone you're dealing with?
It comes from being a nerd in that world, into the research and science of it, because you could see yesterday on, we just did a show on the behavior panel where everybody just, I disagreed with everybody on this about this one woman. There's a couple of kids missing, and I'm under the impression the husband knows where they are or what happened to them, and the wife doesn't. And because she has, we're seeing a big grief muscle on her and him, we're not seeing anything, but we're seeing all the grief muscle at the wrong time. So we've all done our research. We've all know what's happening. We've all have our own specific opinions because of the experiences we've had. For example, Greg he's hardcore. He's like, no, she knows. And Chase is like, no, I know she knows from being a nerd as well and seeing this. And on my side, I'm saying, okay, well, I'm nerding out with you, but I see it because of this. That's when your own decisions have to be made. And that's where the experience part comes in. So you can look at that, and because we could all be wrong about everything, you know, just because I the stuff I know and the stuff I've read, I could call it wrong. You know, I could be completely wrong. Obviously one of us is wrong or three of us are wrong and one of us is right. But you know, somebody's not right in there. So you can't see it as the study itself is an absolute. You know, you just have to take, that's why you look for more than one thing. So now I'm going back. We finished the show yesterday. We're in YouTube jail right now, waiting for it to come out. But I'm back watching that and seeing what I've missed on this girl that they're seeing that I'm not seeing. Or are there things that aren't going on? And of course I say, oh, okay, maybe I'm wrong here. But I go, nah, I'm right about this. So it's a lot of it is your experience and having gone through stuff and studying. You always hear about, oh, study this and that. That's why the people that get on my last nerve are the body language experts that have just Googled what they've learned. I mean, that's basically what my TEDx talk was about people who do that and why you can't tell everything, because you do make a and I stole the phrase from Greg Hartley, a body language Frankenstein of body language. You make a Frankenstein, I know what the shoulder means. So you grab a shoulder and stick it on there. I know what this means. I stick it on there. Scratching your nose means this. So you stick it on, you get this thing walking around. And every time it does something, you think you know what it is. And you assign that thing to everyone that you meet. And you say, that's what that means. That's what that is. But it's not, because we're all humans. We're all different. So Viva, you're always saying, well, I think this, but you're right. Nobody's right about all this all the time. Nobody.
No, but I guess the difference between success being a good one and being a bad one is how often you're right versus, you know, like in poker, you get it right sometimes. And what makes a pro is they get it right more often than they get it wrong. But actually, and Robert, speaking of the Chauvin trial, you know, they the prosecution did make a lot of that still image of Chauvin with his, you know, in the position. And at one point they mentioned that in the video, he was more interested in picking stones out of the tread in the tire than he was in the life and well-being of George Floyd. And I said, that's an interesting way of depicting it. As prosecution, I would expect nothing less. But then I said, from the other side, one could look at that and see it totally differently. Like one can see it as sort of a distraction from a threat. And I said, projecting my own life, when I used to get in trouble as a kid, first thing you do is pick things out of your fingernails. You look at your shoes. You distract yourself with silly things to distract from the stress. What did you think of Chauvin's demeanor, and what did you think of any of those incidents if you were following it? I don't know how close you were following it.
Me or Robert?
Oh, you, Scott. Sorry.
Oh, you know, I didn't watch any of that. I haven't seen any of it. I not that I'm not interested, and I hope it all goes well, but I haven't been on top of that at all. I think we all know where it's headed, but I haven't watched any of it. I haven't weighed in on any of it. Because I don't have anything to back it up, anything to say about it, because I haven't watched it.
When did you first started getting involved in trials, in the sense of whether it's witnesses, trials, other aspects like that, incorporating the same set of skills into that arena?
That started in the mid-2000s as well. Because when I started at the Entrepreneur Center, you meet a lot of attorneys there. So a lot of attorneys are like some of my best friends, because they're there all the time for the startups. You want to get to know attorneys so you can introduce them to them, people that you know and trust, you know. And so Sam Miller is a wonderful attorney here in town. And so he's one great example. So it came from saying, well, if I have somebody that I'm going to do a deposition and they're going to do would you mind talking to them about? So it's like, no, sure, I won't mind talking to them at all. So you sort of start there. You kind of work for nothing at that point. And then you can start charging. And then when you start going and you look at people in groups, people say, well, you can't tell anything from somebody, if, you know, in void air, just because they, you know, you just have one question. Well, you're not watching just the one question. You're watching how they react to other questions. You're watching them in the parking lot. You're watching them sit down. You're watching who they're talking to, how they act. You're watching all those things. And then when you get to ask questions, that's when you start making the decisions about what they said. Do they really mean that? Or they say that because somebody else said that? Or they think it looks cool in front of all these people. That's one thing a lot of people don't take into consideration. These people are giving their answers in front of a lot of people. There's a lot of people there watching them going, what's this answer going to be? So you got to sound cool and you got to sound these things. So a lot of times, it's not just the answer. It's how they answer it. What is it based from, more of a creative standpoint, more of an analytical standpoint? Is it coming from somewhere that where they're trying to make everybody think they're cool? There's a lot of things to take into consideration for those kind of things. So that's basically where I really started getting into that was in the mid 2000s.
How many trials have you been an expert in?
I've not done any where I go in and get on the stand up and say, here's what I think about stuff on the stand or anything like that. I mean, who are you going to have come do that? But from working consulting. From consulting, gosh, I don't know. I don't know a lot. Okay. I don't know, but not like a million or a thousand or anything like that. Not nowhere near that. But I mean, I don't know. I'd have to say, it's like, how many startups have you worked with? I don't know, you know, but I know it's a heck of a lot of them, you know.
Was there anything about it that surprised you? Like, at least from my perspective going in, you know, given you have, you know, movies and books and other things out there about jury selection, TV shows like Bull that are just about jury selection, is just one illustration. Getting into it, and, you know, it shows like Lie to Me, which were fascinating, that I expected a lot more nuance in what lawyers did in the jury selection process. And 90% of them, in Chauvin's case, another example, doesn't appear they had any jury at all. They had no body language people, apparently, from what I could tell. And it's and that's been my experience. Most lawyers don't. And I think it's a massive, massive mistake because they don't understand how the human brain operates. To what degree was that surprising, reaffirming, or what else was unexpected as you got into that space?
That nobody really understood it. Nobody saw that was, they were trying to do it. And they'd say, oh, I know he thinks this because this, we need to, you know, you want to find the person who's in charge. You want to find the person who's going to be talking to everybody. Why would they be? Because you need, you know, if they're in the military, it's probably going to be the person talking to them, depending on what their rank was. So there are different things you need to look for in there. I was surprised at what they thought body language meant. Well, she just looks whatever it was, or he just looks whatever. And I was like, are you kidding me? You know, that's not what's going on there at all, man. You're kidding me. No, I've seen this before. I know this. This guy, he looks like this. So this is the kind of person he is. I was like, man, I got canned from a couple of things because I said that. I said, you have an earthly head. And just tell him, look, man, that's not the way it works. That's what I know from doing this for so long, for so many years. I'm sorry, man. You're wrong. You're wrong. That's why you've hired me.
So, what one person just asked, what makes someone hard to read? What makes it difficult to analyze someone? I mean, when you deal with people on the spectrum, when you deal with people with, say, diagnosable mental disorders like sociopathy or whatever, other than being able to read that they have an issue or they have a diagnosable condition, perhaps, what makes someone harder to read or easier to read?
It's hard to read a schizophrenic because a lot of times you don't know they're schizophrenic. You know, if you spend enough time with them and they have an episode or something, you're like, oh gosh, I see what's going on now. Autistics, who I have a great respect for, they're everybody thinks they're hard to read. They're really not. And they're some of the nicest people in the whole wide world. They just don't know how to, they don't show how they feel. They want to express how they feel, but they don't know how. And it's some of this, it's so sad sometimes because they want to tell you they like you and they want to tell you they're interested, but they just don't know how. They don't know what to say. They don't know how to look. One of the things I look for when I'm dealing with someone who is I think might be autistic is their eyebrow movement. You don't see much in there for most of them, you know? So this person's on the spectrum. I think so-and-so, a lot of times they're not at all. They're just shy, or that's just the kind of person they are. You run into somebody who doesn't talk a lot, or they're just sort of socially awkward. They go, oh, he's on the spectrum, or she's on the, when that's not the case at all. Or they say, I think I'm on the spectrum because of so-and-so. No, unless you've been diagnosed and you go get that checked out, don't be saying that.
Did we talk about this with Eric? It seems like we may have talked about it, but everyone says, probably, you know, Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg on the spectrum. And they go back to, you know, Bill Gates's deposition way back in the day when he was like, you know, rocking back and forth like he was like a caged animal in a zoo who's in distress, or Zuckerberg, who seems to be, you know, lacking the normal human inflection. I say normal, but lacking inflection such that people want to go and diagnose. Either of these two, do you have any opinions on anything you've seen that would indicate to you that they have a diagnosable issue, or just awkward interviewers?
I think they're just really smart. I mean, I think Bill Gates, you're talking about the guy who, the Apple, or not Apple, whoops, I get shot for that, but the Microsoft guy, you know, it's the first computer everybody had. And it's, and no, I don't think he was. I don't anymore. I don't think Steve Jobs is or was. He's just a big thinker. And sometimes those people, when they think a lot, they shoot, man, they think a lot. Zuckerberg, I think he's just odd. He's just a weird dude. I don't think he's autistic at all. I think he's just weird. And he's a giant nerd. I mean, that's what I think. I mean, I think he's just one of those guys. He's never going to be real cool or anything. So, but he's in that position where he's got, you know, billions of dollars. And everybody tells him he's cool. So I don't think he really knows how to act. So maybe he's just doing what he thinks he ought to be doing, what a smart person looks like. Obviously, he's really, really smart, you know, but I don't think he's autistic by any means. I don't think Bill Gates is either one of them. But people may have, you know, they'll have their reasons for saying it. And I know I'll get trashed for that, but that's what I think.
Well, yeah, in your book on body language, you talk about, you know, interviewing and other aspects. But one of the fascinating sort of everyday aspects is dating and social relationships. Have you ever applied that to for friends, family, anything like that? You're going to sit there, just take a little look, see if maybe he's lying, you know, things like that.
Oh, yeah. I've been to restaurants and them meeting with their person, and then me sitting, you know, two tables over and watching them. Those kind of things are going to a party and say, well, so I'll go to this thing, you go to them, just keep an eye on them, what you think. Yeah, tons of that, you know, which is cool. I don't mind doing that at all. Or just meet them. Let's go out and eat, and you meet them, see what you think. As long as they don't say, here's what this guy does, then everything turns, you know, you get a pretty good read on them. If not, they get that thing where they'll think about it for a little while, but then it'll go away. You know, they'll forget, especially if you can talk to them and make them at ease so they don't even think about that. You know, so yeah, that I get that a lot, which is fine. I don't mind doing that. You know, here's what I think about that person.
Shocking discoveries, like so-and-so, really, really bad, and everybody was happy about them.
Yeah. There was a situation where a friend of mine had married this guy, and I didn't know him very well. And we went, to make a long story short, and he and I had gotten into a business thing together. He said, come over to the house and eat with us. And I said, okay. And so we go over, and I knew the girl much better than I knew the guy. And we went over to eat, and then and I knew when I walked in the house, I said, this guy is, he's being violent with her. This is not good. We got to go. We're going to leave. I won't tell you his name, because he's loose in Canada right now. And I think they're looking for him to make it long, because he ended up doing some really horrible things. And I saw it then. I said, oh God. And I told my wife, I said, we got to get out of here. This is my first marriage. And I said, I got the worst headache. We got to go. We got to go. She said, what are you talking? I said, I've got a migraine. She said, you don't get migraines. I said, well, I've got one now. We got to go. Because I didn't know what to think at that point. I could tell by the way she was acting around him when he would get close, the things she would do that let me know that's what was happening. And I was right. And I went to her and I said, look, I can see what's going on. You need to do something about this. And that sort of triggered the him being out of the picture, let's say. So it can go good or bad.
Now we'll jump ahead a bit now, because you have now started the Behavior Panel channel. When did you, I'm going to mess up all the names. I have to go to my notes.
Greg Hartley, Mark Bowden, and Chase Hughes.
Okay. You started this relatively.
CIA mind control guy. So you got to keep a special eye on him. Mark Bowden is the guy who ran naked through the football field. Greg like a Marine and spent some time in the military. So that's
Army,
the
yeah.
Quick
yeah.
script.
That's, yeah. Greg, you don't want to get mad at you. You know, my big fear with Greg is we're in a group of people. He'll get up and shut the door and beat us all to death with each other. that's always my main fear with him.
For anybody who's watching that doesn't know that the Behavior Panels, the four of these guys who break down, analyze things that are, you know, basically due to interviews what Robert and I do with legal stuff, just break it down and explain it. And it's phenomenally interesting. The question is, though, you started recently. How did the four of you meet and get together with this channel? And what has the growth been like?
Okay. Well, Greg and I, but like in 2014, we were talking about putting together just for giggles. We would do a thing where we'd get people who'd seen Bigfoot, you know, and been and UFOs, and then break down their body language and say what he wanted to have. He's like, we'd do a whole thing on that. I was like, yeah, it sounds great. So we, of course, we never had time to do it, you know. And then Mark and I knew Mark from the outskirts of body language because that cat's everywhere, you know. Everybody knows Mark. And so we kind of got to know each other that way. And Greg and I became friends when I did my TED Talk because I told you I took his thing, body, you know. He said in his book, one of his books, his 11 books, you create a body language, a Frankenstein's monster of body language, and I called it body language Frankenstein. So I had to call him up and say, hey, look, man, I'm doing this. I want you to know I just did a TEDx talk on this, and I didn't check with you first, you know. So that's how he and I met. So he called and said, we talked for a while. And then, hi, Carla. And then, so we were talking one day, the COVID thing had hit. You know, he said, what we ought to do? He said, let's, and Mark and I had talked about, yeah, let's do something. And I'd met Chase through Eric Hundley's show, because he was really into Columbo and I'm really into Columbo. So I was like, oh, we got something to talk about. So he and I talked on the phone a couple of times. And I was like, oh, this guy's a really great guy. And then, and Mark and I had talked. Mark was like, let's do a video together. Okay, great. And Chase's like, we should do videos together. And Greg's always like, we should do, not just to me, but to each other. And then Greg said, look, let's get everybody on the, together. Let's do a Zoom and let's pick something to talk about. So we picked the Tiger King. It was huge at the time because COVID had just taken off. And so had that. And so we said, okay, we'll do it. So we got together. We said, well, let's do this and see if we like it. Didn't plan on having a channel. Didn't plan on anything else but doing it the one time. And you can tell because at the end we say, we should do this again. So we just took those and I'll tell you what, I'll get some clips of it. Some part would look at them, tell each other what we think. Okay. And that was it. And so it went. So we decided we'd do another one. We did who we do next? I think we did Biden next. We got like, you know, 2 million views. We're like, yeah, this is going pretty good. We should do another one. So we just every Tuesday we do them, and we let them go on Wednesday. And if we get out of YouTube jail in time, they come out on Thursday. So and everybody thinks they go, oh, they're all so nice to each other. They all get along. And that's the part. Like for me, it throws me because we were hanging out and doing that anyway. And I guess from watching those TV shows where there's always a mean guy and there's always a too nice guy and all that, we're never mad at each other because I really want to know what these guys have to say. And they really want to know what all of us other ones have to say because we see the same stuff, but we'll call it something different. We'll see it begin at a different point. We'll see a different reason for that thing to happen. But it's all the same thing. We all see the same things pretty much. Every now and then somebody will miss something completely and Greg will nail. So here's this part here. And we go, oh, geez, totally missed it. And you can tell by watching this, we've missed something because we're trying to be cool about it. Like, I knew that. But when we start acting like we're too cool about it, and you go, Mark didn't know that, or Chase didn't, or Greg didn't, or I didn't. You can watch those things.
Now, so we started watching each other. You're up to 250,000 subs within a year, and it's a long format. That's another thing. Like, your shows go anywhere between 1 and 2 hours typically?
Yeah. 1.5, 2 hours.
What is the most... Start off with the most memorable breakdown that you've done since the channel started for anybody who's watching.
Well, okay. It was for me, I think it was the alien one, or it was the UFO one with, I can't remember the guy's name, Bob Lazar. That was the UFO guy. Because when we do these, we're not on for just an hour and a half, 2 hours. We get on 30, 45 minutes before that. And we goof off for about, you know, an hour, 45 minutes and see what everybody's been doing and all that. And then in between the things, we'll be doing something that's horrible, like a murder or something, come back laughing because it looks like we've watched this clip where you come back and we're just laughing, but we've been goofing off. And then it's okay, we got to get back to this. Okay. And then we get back to that. Looks like we're laughing. But the most fun for me was the one with the, where this woman, claims she's been picked up by aliens and has alien children. That was just, if you're into funny stuff, that was just a freebie. I mean, everything she said was just she was lobbing them to us, you know. and so Chase is being all serious, and then finally Mark's laughing and Greg's laughing. I'm like, you gotta be kidding me. This is because it's crazy sounding what she's saying, whether it happened to her or not, which I don't believe it did. Then and I don't believe she's schizophrenic. I just think she's, you know, just doing it to be a famous UFO person. But that for me was a lot of fun. I really like that. I like every one of them. That's the thing. I really look forward to doing it every week. And we always say at the end, man, I'm having the best time doing this. So we really are having the best time. It's like hanging out with the four best friends you got and just goofing off the whole time and going, oh, let's do this for a minute. And you get serious on it.
Not to ask for medical opinion. Your most popular video on the channel thus far is Joe Biden interview with Mika. I forget her last name. 2.7 million views. Having watched Joe Biden now, I mean, do you think that there is diagnosable cognitive decline? And to the extent that there is, how much does that affect, you know, what you might read into his behavior or read into his interviews now versus his interview almost a year ago?
They've changed a lot. His interviews have changed a lot. And it's as we all grow older, we all, you know, have certain things that happen to us, I'm sure, that make those things, make things worse and make your communication skills a little bit tougher to use. I don't want to get near that thing, man. So I'm sure we all have situations that come up where we can't communicate as good as we would want to or hope to. And I think maybe he might be experiencing that. How's that sound?
Now, how did you get into to train within like the military, Secret Service? How did that start to happen?
It's sort of by word of mouth, you know, because somebody's, dude, you need to talk to this guy. He'll show you exactly what somebody will say. I know this is going to happen. This guy's going to run because, or I know this person has a gun or a weapon because, and here's what I saw. And I learned because this guy told us. Who told you that? Do you think you come talk to us? Yeah. So that's how it started for me. And the next thing I know, I'm standing in a room with a bunch of guys with green berets on going, holy smokes. You know, I can't believe I'm standing here talking. So then after a while you get confidence with it, you feel fine. And you realize that they don't know more than you do about that. You think these people, you think they're trained to know all these little nuances of stuff. And you think they've read as much as you have because they're all so gifted and talented and just smart, man. They're just brilliant. And you realize they don't know what you know, but they want to get that information. So you come in and, man, they tell you that they'll climb in your brain and not let you go until they've got all of it. So, and it's every one of those situations that every one of them want every bit of it.
Now, where did you start doing things like the body language workshops, the true crime workshops, those other aspects? How did that come about?
Greg and I started that not long after I started, after I did that TEDx talk I was telling you about back in 2014. And we talked about it all the time. Finally, in 2017 is we put up bodylanguagetactics.com. And that thing, when COVID hit, it blew up. It was like the Tiger King of body language courses. And so I started checking. So who else has got stuff like what we're doing? And there really weren't very many. They weren't selling very well. And I came across a couple of things that said the number one body language course is this one. We were on. I was like, oh, we're number one. But what does that mean? You know, and we saw two or three things like that. I said, oh, it's going to be the number one. We'll just start telling everybody that. And that's the one everybody goes to is bodylanguagetactics.com. So after that, we started getting, my wife is really into true crime, loves it. Can't get enough of it. And she's always saying, yeah, you should do these people. You should do this thing. And Greg's wife is the same way. Dina, she's the same way. My wife, Amber, and his wife, Dina. And we said, well, we should do something, you know, because they're all the time saying we should do a course on that. So we put together the True Crime Workshop. And what we did was we watched a couple of those and saw the structure of it and see how you do, how it's the same thing. It happens in real life. It's true crime. So that we talk about, we go through the structure of a true crime, you know, what triggers the crime happens, then it triggers a cycle of, you have to lie about it. The person has to lie about it. We go through what a lie cycle is. It's called the liar's loop. Nobody's done that before. We haven't broken that down. We've actually started putting in our training now when we're training law enforcement and the military, because you know, it never hit me, but Greg's like, you know what? There's this thing, and we can call it the liar's loop. I think we've talked to you guys about that before on Eric's thing. So we put that together, and the True Crime Workshop .com, that thing blew up too. I mean, we've got so many people and so many different kinds of people. So then we started hearing people go, we want a membership site, which is what this is. Like, we want to, you know, it's, and I'm like, what is that? They're like, it's like Facebook. I said, okay, Facebook for body language. They're like, yeah, that's the one. So we said, okay, we did like a little test run of it. Got slammed. So, and it was just literally a very, really small version of that. And we had the best time in there. and you train, and we would talk to people. We do something like this, like we'll do like a surprise, you know, Skype thing. You'll get an email, goes, "Hey man, I'm going to be in here in the community thing. Why don't you come talk to me for 30 minutes?" And those people will be able to come on and talk to you. You'll get three or four or five in there, and they can all ask you questions. So we decided, since that was going so well, we would offer it, you know, do a public thing. And it's really, and to do, you think, oh, it must be pretty expensive because it's a monthly thing, but it's cheap. It's really inexpensive because we want people to come in because we like doing it, because we learn from other people and they learn from us. So we give them a lesson every week or every month. We have a new lesson, and we do these things every month. They get a lesson. They get an interview with where we interview somebody, a famous person, a musician, an actor, or a homicide detective or an interrogator. And then we have some an MP3 or something. We'll do articles to give them an MP3 so they can start their own audiobook of what we're giving them. And it's all new stuff. So and we don't give it to them all at once, all this stuff, so they don't feel overwhelmed. So you get it slowly but surely every month, and you become, and it really educates you on human behavior in a nutshell. It's not even a nutshell, but
yeah. But hold on, you got into the liar's loop, but take for granted, a lot of people might not have seen or heard that explanation on Eric's. Try to explain the liar's loop, because people are going to love it.
Okay. Well, the liar's loop is what happens. Let's when someone's telling a lie, and it pretty much any kind of lie you're going to tell. Let's say there's somebody that's killed somebody. And so in the true crime workshops, one of the first things we talk about, because the whole thing is based off of that. And the first thing that happens is they tell a lie, but why are they lying? There's got to be a trigger for the lie. They've killed somebody. They say, oh, I've got to make something up and say I was somewhere else. What are my lies going to be? So that's the trigger. That's what triggers the lie. Then they have to create the lie. They have to fabricate it. So that's step two in the loop, is to fabricate it. And once you fabricate it, you have to deconflict it and say, okay, I was here and this happened. That's why I wasn't there. You have to say, you have to deconflict everything you're going to tell them. After that, you pitch it. Because you feel like, okay, I've got, here's where I was, even though I did this crime, I'm going to say I was here, I've got everything worked out, okay, I'm ready. And then you go in and pitch it. And then that's when you say, hey, I was here, I did this, I was outside and came in and they were dead or whatever. So after that, that's when the cops show up. So at that point, you start defending. What did you do? Because you have to keep pitching then. And they'll ask you little things, because the detectives haven't showed up yet. So they'll ask you little things. And so you deconflict again. And then you go back in, you have to repitch what you've deconflicted. And finally the detectives show up and you get to start dealing with them. So when you start dealing with them, you've really got to go through what's going on and say, okay, I've deconflicted this, but shoot, they found something here. So what you're basically trying to get them to do is go from that defend thing and deconflict and defend and deconflict until you get into what we call the death spiral of a lie. So there's really no way out of it. In interrogation, that's what you do. You just box somebody in where they can't say, okay, you know, they don't ever say, okay, you got me. But in other words, that's what you're trying to do. And if you'll follow the liar's loop, it'll take you right down that path and show you how to do that. And every time somebody starts telling you something you don't believe and you throw one of these little things in there, you can see them go back to defend or deconflict or fabricate, because you try to get them back into that fabrication. So they just keep making stuff up, and you can only make stuff up for a little while. So once you get them that, and that starts that loop, and then it just goes and they go right down the drain. So it's a powerful tool, and we've actually started using it and train law enforcement now and military as well. So, and it's really become something big, and I'm glad it's something that we came up with that nobody's has presented before or has taught or shown before. It's actually something new. So we're going to be talking about it in the body language membership as well, because people will ask about that.
Now, what was it like being on Dr. Phil?
It was great. You know, he's a great guy. Yeah, he really is. He's funny. He's hilarious, that guy. He really is. And Greg and I just met with him down in Atlanta a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago, something like that, or a week ago, something like that. And great guy. I mean, really, 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 you'd like him. Y'all get along great, because he's, you know, he's when you sit down with him, he's just like you are. You know, he's just, you know, you say, oh, that person's just like us. This guy's just like you. He just have to be Dr. Phil and have a bunch of TV shows and stuff and be loaded. But he's a normal old guy. And you can tell the way he talks about things and approaches things, and the things he thinks are funny, you think are funny too. So it's all, he's just a regular old guy.
I'm sure I would have problems looking and digesting Dr. Phil, because I would only see Will Ferrell playing Dr. Phil. I think it was Will Ferrell who did it.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, now here's another question. You've done like these interrogations that we've seen on the internet, where people are interrogating people to get confessions. You've done these things many times. Oh, yeah. I mean, I say on a spiritual level, what is it like looking into someone like that? And on a practical level, what was, if you, without getting into the details, what was the most memorable experience you've had?
A lot of times I work with a lot of finances, a lot of finance situations where somebody stole a lot of money. That's my favorite. My favorite is the con and the psychopath and the person who's stolen a lot of stuff. Cause I don't know. I've just always been in my wheelhouse. So, one time I was talking to a person and I tell, this is one of the stories I tell all the time. As I'm talking to this person, we got down to the part where, so, you know, the Sam, and this was, someone that was from the EC, from Entrepreneur Center. And I was talking to him, and there's a situation where they weren't a good person and they'd taken a bunch of money they shouldn't have taken. So I finally get this person, I get him boxed in. It was, you know, I was maybe an hour, you know, it's fairly short. So I get in there and I finally get him boxed in, and I said, there comes a point in interrogation where you put your hand on him, you go, we've all made mistakes. You know, you touch him and you get that one-on-one thing happening with him. And so I said, so I understand what's going on. You understand. Everyone here understands what's going on. Why don't, you know, let's see if we can work out you writing down at least an apology. Because all I like to do is get them to write an apology. So they're really writing a confession. So I work it. So they write an apology, which you can take out. Ah, here's a confession. So I said, why don't we just at least where you can sit down and write an apology. And this guy goes, oh, yes, Lord. Yes, Lord. And then he comes back and starts talking to me again and told me everything. And I was like, I totally missed it the whole time. I totally didn't see this guy had some kind of thing going on. You know, it was a schizophrenic. And that's one of the funniest ones for me ever. That was. And when we get off here, I've got one more that I'll tell you guys when we're done.
The funny thing is, it's like, it's not much different than the practice of law, except you're just on the criminal side. And as lawyers, we do this in depositions. We do this with our own clients where you meet a new client, they become a client, and then you start to learn things about them the more you meet with them, which is why I've always said, like, knowing how to pick a client is the most important thing, because knowing what files to take or clients to take and what clients to reject is, you know, and when you're young, all you want to do is take clients. You don't care who they are, but then you start to learn who they are and identifying problem clients. I mean, it's just effectively what you're doing, just for crimes. It's
That was one thing. Both you and Greg and the other members have at different times gone into some of the common mistakes interviewers, interrogators, deposers, lawyers make. Could you describe what some of those are, in the sense that they often, you know, like in one case with Michael Jackson, they bailed him out when he was actually in trouble in the questioning. Could you give some illustrations of what some of those, the most common mistakes questioners make in trying to get to accurate information?
The big one is not knowing when to shut up and when to keep being quiet, because you can ask a question and you'll sit. And once you ask the question, you wait and don't let it, once it starts to dawn on them, don't add anything to it. That's, if I had one thing and they said, well, you're Scott Roskin, if you're one thing on interrogation, shut up, ask your question and just wait and watch. And once they answer, wait and watch. Just keep waiting. Just keep watching. Because they'll get uncomfortable and they'll start telling you more stuff. So that's the most important thing, is knowing when to shut up and when to just be quiet and to give it a little like that, you know, and how to look at them when you're being quiet. That's one thing that bothers me about these people who do TV interviews. They'll ask them a question. They'll ask them these leading questions. They'll ask them questions where they can get out. They'll answer them for them. Like you guys know how your attorneys know how that works. So those are the things that bug me to death. I'm not as good at questioning as you guys would be, because you guys think of stuff that we'd never think of, you know. But that's the main thing, is knowing to be quiet.
Well, because in that same context, I mean, my experience is that lawyers sort of get caught up in their own wanting to prove something rather than wanting to find out whatever the truth may be. And then consequently, that's where they don't tend to be patient, don't tend to just let people sort of hang themselves or just let people tell you who they are. I mean, that may or may not be damning in this particular circumstance, but you find out more in the sort of preparatory stages for trial. What if anything has surprised you in the sense of watching depositions of lawyers? Because I mean, you guys have broken down a good number of those. What if anything has been the surprising part in that context?
That the attorneys don't understand what's happening in a deposition. They do, but at the same time, some of them don't. They don't understand that you get so much out of those things. You can go watch them later, and you can learn so much for that. From that, I think it's why I get a lot of gigs of watching those videos, breaking them down, and sending them back to the attorneys, because they'll miss so much. They'll ask the right questions, and you'll see it all over them. But then they'll pretend that what I'm seeing or what somebody I know is seeing, they totally miss it, and they've dismissed the whole thing. Where they go and say, "Hey, what about this, man?" That's where you climb up their onion, and they don't do that. That's the main thing. I was about to go on a tangent there. Sorry. Oh, wait, you're muted. I can't hear you.
Yeah, I'm putting on mute so we don't hear the noise from upstairs. It reminds me, I was in a deposition once. It's one of my funnier memories, but I was in a deposition and I had my earbuds, and I knew that the other attorney was noticing me put my earbud in my mouth, like not in the mouth, just like put it in your mouth. And I knew it was driving him crazy, but it was absolutely distracting him from what would otherwise have been a very bad deposition of my client. And after the deposition, he's like, "You put your earbud in your mouth." And I was like, "Yes." I pretended like I was doing it by accident, but it was very interesting just to see someone getting distracted and not paying attention to the answers and the demeanor of the person being testified, being deposed. And it was a strategic lack of hygiene, although I have no problem with my own inner ear stuff. Question for Scott. And this is one I have as well. Are you ever nervous for the perp about the aftermath of a question you've drawn out of someone? I mean, if you're dealing with financial crimes, maybe a little less risky. I don't know, but yeah. Do you ever get nervous about it?
I'm assuming the question would be, I'm afraid someone's gonna get mad and take a swing at me. So that happens, So well, I'm not afraid to ask anything.
Yeah, I think either that or maybe, do you ever feel bad for them? In other words, someone that you just got to, you're about to confess, do you feel guilty at all or have conflicted?
Depending on what it is. If it's a situation where the person is taking money because they really do need for real, somebody's sick or somebody's, their child is, there's a problem, and I see but that's not my job, is not to say, okay, let's not say anything about that. You can't do that. My thing, I've gotten hired to go out and say, okay, here's what happened. Here's the truth. And this is what happened. Once you slip past that, maybe you can get away with it once, but once you slip past that, then you start making, well, I wonder if I should do, I wonder if I should help this. And you're not helping anyone. You're not there to help that person. You want to be nice and cordial and all that. You don't want to be mad when you leave. You want to like you when you leave. But yeah, you can't be doing that. You can't be doing that.
The question that I was just going to ask was not about being fearful. Jeez Louise, Scott, I just lost my question.
Yeah, that's cool.
Oh, it'll come back. It'll come back in a second.
So, well, this is from our locals board at vivabarneslaw.locals.com. Sort of like bodylanguagemembership.com, local community where you can have some fun. Here's one of the questions. Can you imagine being a high school boy trying to date Scott's daughter? Scott would give the poor kid one look and say, nope, you're gone. Any thoughts on that?
Man. Yeah, well, I don't have any kids, I don't think. So,
any nieces, any nephews?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Ever been asked to take a look at niece or nephew's would-be husband or spouse or boyfriend or girlfriend?
Not yet. They're too little. They're too young.
Yes.
Not yet. I'm sure it's going to be. Well, wait a minute. No. Yeah. Yes. Okay. Here. Yeah, we did. I should say that because she's probably watching. But yeah. Okay. I'll tell you. My nephew has a girlfriend and everybody loves her. And so of course she came over and said, "Well, let's get a look at her and tell us what you think. Let us know what you think." I said, "Okay, we'll get a look." And I loved her. She's wonderful. Everything she's said she was and supposed to be, she's that. So.
I remember my question now, Scott. Okay. But before I get to it, I want to get to this super chat question right here, which was, love the content, Scott. In your experience as a music producer and body language analyst, do you have a favorite psychopath character from movies or TV?
I really liked Billy Bob Thornton when he was in, what was the TV show? It was a movie.
Fargo.
Oh, man.
Sling Blade.
Yeah, Sling Blade was good too, but in Fargo, man, he was great. He did such a great job at that. He's my favorite actor. So he was, man, he did such a great job in that. He really did.
Yeah, that was season one, I think, of Fargo.
Yeah, I think that was a good season one of something
that was fantastic. Yeah. When he calls up the twins or those brothers and lets them know that that has like dark humor but great humor all the way through.
Yeah.
Now, this is the question that I was going to ask. It's not about whether or not Gavin Newsom is a psychopath or whether or not politicians are psychopaths in your experience. Although I might get to that one. So they say when you're deposing someone, sometimes you have to be a good cop, sometimes you have to be a bad cop. I look at your demeanor. I'm not sure that you could convince me that you would be the bad cop. So did you have a bad persona when you were trying to get answers, or did you always have basically your own relatively sincere persona demeanor, which seems more like the nice guy to get the truth by being a friend as opposed to getting the truth by being intimidating?
I'm the one that's usually the nice guy, you know, and you have some like Greg.
You're the Viva.
Yeah, exactly. I'd be you, and then Greg would be Barnes. So that's what usually works out. But keep in mind, interrogation is theater for one. So you can go in and whatever it takes you need to, if it's my turn or whoever's going to be in, go and be the mean person, you can do that as well. Because as nice as I may look, I can assure you I can come on just the other direction with that. Not being a mean person, but you sure would think I was. You know, everybody likes to say that, I know, but that's just part of a skill set you got to have where you can really seem like you're not a very good person at all. Not to fear me or anything, but just be it,
You know, one thing that I think is sort of mythology is I think in general for interrogation techniques, though we might see it as mean, playing good cop tends to work a lot better than playing bad cop. Yeah. Is that a fair interpretation?
Think of it like this. If we were you won't count with you guys, but if you were being interrogated, you sat down in the room, what four words are you going to say right out of the gate? I want my lawyer, you know, that'd be it. And it's over. So the key is to get that person to want to be there with you and want to stay there with you and to trust you and to know that you've got their back and that you're there to help them. That's what you want them to think. So it's important to have that demeanor. It's important to be likable. And all those things I was telling you about earlier from that guy in the grocery store, you see all these things and you start putting those together and start saying there's a thing called a theme. And if you're trying to get you're trying to connect with that person, you already know their background from reading their stuff in their background. And so you'll have a little story that you've told 1,000 times, but you'll just put their name in it. You know, if somebody's, going in, the guy's he's lost his house and he's got a car that he hasn't paid off, you know, all these things about him financially. He has kids and they're having real money problems. One of the themes for example, really just a bad pitch is, you remind me of my old roommate. And years after we were in college, he had a problem too. And I always use Andrew Connor, my roommate from Boston. I said, He reminds me because, and this person doesn't know I know their background. They don't know I know all this stuff. He got married. He got out of college, found this girl, got married. They had 2 kids. And then he, you know, then bought a car because he thought his gig was going to make a bunch of money. Then he lost the gig. And then one of his parents passed away and couldn't back him up. And he made some mistakes as well. He made a mistake, you know, similar to what you did. And he got out of it. I don't know what would have happened to him. You know, if he hadn't, and I think about that sometimes, but he was really lucky. So you can, you use nice things to make it look like in your theme, that you're trying to help them. You know, I'm connected with you. I see where you're coming from. You remind me of this. And I'm telling you about somebody else who's similar to you, even though I don't know your background, but oh, it's nice. You know, we're making a connection here. So it's all about making that person think that you have their best interest at heart.
Well, and it's
that answer your question?
Yeah, no, it makes me think like when you're trying to get something from someone, kindness is the way. And when you're trying to rule over someone, fear is the way. So
I think you can intertwine it. Like the one you guys did of that Canadian detective of the colonel, I thought was a classic illustration of the best way to do this. And I learned a lot of my deposition tactics from a big plaintiff's lawyer, and he was very, very good at this. He was good at getting people to say what he needed them to say, sometimes by convincing them that by saying what they were saying was the opposite of what the other person thought wanted to hear. But it was very rarely that it was adversarial. that he didn't find being overtly adversarial almost ever advantageous to getting the information he wanted. That basically it's different. It's like good cop instead of good cop, bad cop.
Yeah, rarely do you. I've never heard anybody say, "Where's the pan on the? Where's the girl? Where's the this?" You know, you didn't. Nobody does that. I mean, I'm sure they do somewhere, but that's TV. Yeah, same thing with like Lie to Me, you know, and those types of things where you see these things, you go, "What?" But you talk to Ekman and he'll say, "No, it's TV. That's just no, it was TV. What about this? They said this. Yeah, and I was, it was TV." Yeah, I haven't talked to him, but I know people who have, and they said, "Yeah, he says it's TV." So,
Are there any? If people want to watch first of all, good reading for people who want to get into this. Where do they start, and where do they go?
I always say that the first three heads on the on Mount Rushmore of body language are Joe Navarro. So I would start with this book he's got called "What Everybody Is Saying." I should say, you should get, what's my book? Oh, yeah. I should be saying, you should get Understanding Body Language because it starts, but Joe's, that's where you'd start. And then I would suggest probably Greg Hartley's books. He's got several that are really, really good. They're really good books that are really easily explain all these things you know and that you're familiar with. Start with Joe, go to Greg. Mark's books are great. Mark Bowden, Chase Hughes has some great books as well. Especially if you want to nerd out. And then Scott Rouse has, Understand. So if you do,
which is good. It's a good, quick, breezy read that's not too heavy, but very accessible and shows the various ways you can utilize it in your everyday life. I mean, I felt like the first time I really got into this was figuring out relationships at a bar. Because I was curious, but I was like, oh, so if you watch their lower part of their body language, you can find out all kinds of things that are going on.
Yeah.
And, grew up working in the diner and what have you. So it ended up being very, very helpful because people communicate in so many ways they don't realize they're communicating and give themselves away, good and bad and otherwise. But I liked your book because it was very accessible. It was like what George Gammon is in economics. It makes what is otherwise dense potentially material. Because I think that's the hard part. It's like reading Nassim Taleb or one of those where you got to spend like 10 hours on a single paragraph. It's not, your book's the opposite of that. Very accessible, very ways you can practical information you can use tomorrow. Walking into an interview, I mean, I've found a lot of this stuff helpful in a wide range of contexts, not just law where it can be very, very helpful, but also very, very helpful in many, many other contexts. And the courses are great because I've gone through the True Crime Workshop at least, I think about two-thirds of the way through. That was good. That was fun.
I wish you'd let me know you're going in there. I would have put you in.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, Eric sent me like a thing, so I was able to go boom, boom, boom and go through it. So at least part of it, which was fascinating. I like those kind of things because they're practical. They give you application, not just you don't have to just read it. You can actually interact in such a way that you really, frankly, from a memory perspective, you remember it better. So I find it useful for all of those purposes, too.
Well, thanks, man. Yeah, that's the way we set these things up, is so they're easy to remember. They're not these long lessons, aren't an hour long. They're like 3 minutes, 9 minutes, 7 minutes, because who's got time to sit around and do that forever? So we don't do that thing. We have a bunch of music at the first. We say, now this, go on. We say, okay, here's what you got. And they're done really well. They're done. The video stuff, as you know, is done professionally. But yeah, we decided we want to do, that's why we call it a micro course or micro lessons. They're 3 to 7 to, I think the longest one was 12 minutes. Because who wants to sit around and do anything for that long? You know, then you can go away and come back and watch it all again if you want to. So
I'm asking now, and I don't know if this is the internet, you never know if it's a troll or if I'm asking a bad question. Ask Scott if he knows who Derek Brown is, please.
Derek Brown. I don't know Derek Brown. Maybe he's talking about Darren Brown, the magician. I like his stuff. He's really good. I'm not that into magic, but.
And we got does Scott have any thoughts on truth wizards or areas of disagreement with Ekman?
Oh, Ekman is like the Michael Jackson or the Elvis of what we know as modern body language. I think he's broken ground. Nobody even thought of. So no way to fuss with Ekman. All his stuff spot on as far as I'm concerned.
Any particular universal advice you give people who are saying, okay, I'm going out on a date. What should I look for?
Look for where they look and look for how still they are. and how many, and the way, obviously everybody looks for the way they look at you and all those types of things. But predators have specific things they'll do to let you know they're a predator. They'll be, they'll look at you too long, and it'll be uncomfortable when they look at you too long. And those are the main things, if they look at you too long. And that's what gives, women can do this much better than men can do. You know, I've always, we know that now is a scientific fact. Their brain takes in a lot more information than we do, because it, it takes it in differently and assesses it differently and breaks things up differently. And that's what gives them the most powerful force on the earth, which is women's intuition. And when you get that, and when I would say to women, when you get that little feeling, something might not be right with this guy. He's handsome and he's funny, he's all this stuff, but something's not right. Don't hang out, because that can be real bad for you. You'll know it. You'll get that feeling. You're not supposed to, from having just talked about Ekman, where he says, don't really rely on the feeling part of it because of things that happen. Women, I think it's you can tell a lot from looking at someone, and the feeling you get from being around that person for about an hour. If you get that feeling, just a hint of, I don't know, take that as a 10 on a 1 to 10 of, I don't know, don't hang out with them. But it's how they look at you. It's how long they look at you when they do. That'd be the number one thing I would suggest. If they look at you too long and it makes you uncomfortable, if you look away and look up, they're still looking at you. That's weird. That's
well, there's,
right.
There's the old expression, you know, hating someone's guts, or you know, it makes someone making you sick to your stomach, that there are these sensorial reactions that transcend your conscious thought.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. You're dang right.
Now, have you ever been one-on-one in a room with someone that was like Hannibal Lecter level dangerous?
Yeah. Yeah.
What was that like?
It's interesting, but you got to keep in mind what you're doing. You got to keep your mind on what you're doing.
Is that how you do it? Because, like, I would be a little bit jittery.
No, because there'll be people there. If anything were to happen, they'd pull them off you, you know? So you just have to pay attention to what you're doing. You have to really, and just remember that's why you're there. You don't want to, you have to watch for the things that let you know they're getting angry. You know, there's all kinds of things you can tell in someone when, you know, that the pre-violence things. I got a huge nose, so this will work really good, really well. But you can see if somebody's nose pops just a little bit like that. Even though you may not see very much of it, you can on mine because it's huge. Those are one of the little things you see. And there's little things you'll see that let you know they're getting angry. There's a great interview with a guy named Kuklinski. I can't remember his first name. And he's called the Iceman. I think it's Richard Kuklinski. And he's one of my favorite interviews I've ever watched. And it's just a psychologist talking to him and asking him questions. And you see this guy getting mad. And then finally he tells him he's mad. And the guy interviewing him does such a great job, because he doesn't leave the demeanor he's already got. He doesn't show any fear. Psychopaths, talking about one of the things they see most and fastest and better than anybody else is the expression of fear, because that's about the only expression that they understand, or when they see it, is fear. So when they see that, they know what it is. And this guy showed nothing like that at all. He just kept talking the same way. And finally he calmed back down. And the psychiatrist or psychologist did everything he should do to make sure that thing didn't get out of hand. And I say that thing because it's just a body running around with nobody in it. A psychopath. That's the way I view it anyway. We won't go down that road if you don't want to. And I'll talk about that for hours. But yeah, so you just have to pay attention to what you're doing, because they can be dangerous. They really can. They can, if you're not paying attention, you know, they get at least one good swing in or one good stick in or something. You got to be careful.
Robert, were there any more questions from locals? I was going to go check now to see if we had missed any or gotten any.
Let me check. I'll check that right now.
And let me see here if I had any more questions. Go for it, Robert.
There's something about ask Scott about the Shadow Men and the Mental Medicine book.
I don't know that. I don't know what that is.
Nor do I. That was news to me.
I'm going to write that down, because it sounds like something I should know.
Yeah, it sounds like something interesting.
My question for you, Scott, I mean, how do you, between you and the body panel, the behavior panel experts, mm-hmm. how do you go now continuing to learn and continuing to evolve? Like, once you become the expert of sorts, where do you now go to continue learning and to continue refining your skills?
Yeah, well, for me, I keep rereading the old stuff. People read one book and think, oh, I know this now. I'm going to go out and use it and I understand what Nah, I read Ekman's books all the time. I read Greg's books all the time. I read all the old, the studies of human behavior and body language, how the brain works. There's a never ending supply of that stuff, if you know where to look. sometimes you get a book by somebody and they're just a hack, you know, but you get Dangerous Personalities by Joe Navarro. Read that. And I go through his books all the time. If I could show you all my books over there, sometimes I'll just grab one and just start. What do I get sitting here? Oh yeah. Okay. For example, let's see, I've got this Joe Navarro book just sitting over here. And his are always on Amazon. I'm always like number two. And he's always number one in front of me. Can't believe I'm advertising his books, but
I'm going to see how many of these are available on Audible, because that's the only way I'm going to be able to do this.
They all are. I don't think this one is yet, but this one definitely is. That's the one I was telling you about. You got to get, and to put everybody's books in front of mine, but yeah. So I reread stuff all the time, because you think you're going to remember it all. And some people have great memories and they can remember it all, but you'll pick up something new. You know, you can always learn something, even if you reread somebody's book. Ekman has a bunch of books. Navarro has a bunch of books. Greg Hartley has a bunch of books. And just reading those things and reading all the old stuff. There's so much out there. A lot has changed since the first body language books have come out, so you've really got to be careful with some of that. But if you get into the research of it, which is easy to get into, the real research, even online, when you Google stuff and find it, but make sure you're getting it from the right universities and the right place, because if it's just somebody who's written an article and they haven't done the research, they're telling you what they've Googled from other people like them. And you know, this is my soapbox I get on about that.
One of the locals' questions that was good was, they're a whistleblower and they're having problems with people believing them. And in my experience in representing whistleblowers, they almost always come across as really eclectic personalities, in part because it's what led them to blow the whistle in the first place. It disproportionately like Jerry Lee Lewis, nutty professor, crazy scientist kind of thing. And their demeanor and disposition tends to lead people to think that they're tin hat conspiracy theorists, when often it's just that they have that eclectic independence of thought that led them to blow the whistle. What would be some of your advice to someone who's trying to be have the authority figures accept them and what they're hearing, or at least hear them out when they're a whistleblower?
The key is being yourself and not being, I'm telling you, man, you know, that thing going overboard. Because when they come on like that, after you keep saying the same thing over and over all the time, you go, I don't know, man, this seems kind of weird. But you give them the information. I'll tell them what happened. This is what's happened. And I need to tell you that. And you need to know that and make that your big statement. And then let them ask questions off of that. I mean, because if not, they go, so-and-so's doing this. And I've seen him do this a million times. I'm really bothers me. Think about what you're going to say before you go in. Get your pitch ready for that. It's almost like a presentation you're making if you think about it like that.
Well, yeah, I think that's critical, because, you know, I remember when I was doing the Snipes case, Snipes would get up and say, hey, Barnes, can you do this? And he would do this. He would do a better lawyer than me in 5 seconds. You know, even had the glasses going. He had it all. And I was like, well, I can't be that, because I got to be me, because jurors are going to sense any kind of fakeness at all. And I think it's one of the things that I think that's great advice. It's basically learn how to do the best version of yourself. I used to tell people, it's like, you're at for the folks that grew up in the South, you're at a Cracker Barrel on, you know, sitting out on the front porch with the rocking chair, telling your grandson or niece or nephew or whomever, somebody that's 7 or 8, that age range, a story. And you're going to break it down and you're going to simplify it. You're going to streamline it and you're going to be yourself. And when you put too much pressure on yourself to tell a story is when it comes across as fake, even when it's the pressure that's fake, not you that's fake or the story that's fake.
Right. Right. Yeah. If a fourth grader can't understand it, you're not doing a good job if you can't explain it that simply.
Scott, we got a making a request for Scott's panel to cover the Daniel Holtzclaw interrogations. Okay. I'm just going to read two of these chats. They're good. My dad's first impressions of people is always correct. Do some people just subconsciously read cues? Seems like many people are easily duped. Yeah, that's.
I think people would, to use Myers-Briggs, technology or analysis, people have introverted intuition, I think, spot patterns in other people quicker than others. And I think one part of Lie to Me that was right is that if you've experienced early trauma, I think it enhances that. I think you guys have talked about that.
Too. Yeah, I believe that too.
Because you have to be hyper alert.
Yeah. Because you're afraid. You're afraid something's going to hurt you. Something's going to bother you. You're afraid of for your life a lot of times. So yeah, those people are hyper aware. And yeah, some people are like that. Some people are so much more adept at reading human behavior than others.
We got Jane.
I assume it's just the length of time. You really, how much do you put into the 10,000 hours thing? because of the, you know, the idea that once you've done 10,000 hours, then you're truly an expert. How much of that do you think was true? How much have you improved over time by the amount of time you've spent on it? And how much, once you got to a certain point, you really were there and there's only marginal advantages therefore going forward? Yeah.
I'm not so sure it's 10,000 hours. I mean, it could be less than that. It could be more than that. But it seems like you're learning. To me, I'm learning all the time. I learn all the time. So no matter how many hours I put in, I'm still going to go read. I'm never going to go, oh, I got this, man. Okay. What do you want to know? Let's do that. Because that's why I say, shoot, I could be wrong. You know, I could completely be wrong. And I'm not wrong a lot, but I'm sure I am sometimes. I just don't know it yet. But yeah. That you can always learn. So I don't know if it's 10,000 hours. I mean, it makes sense when you think about it and hear about it. And I actually think he came across later and said, you know, maybe it isn't that, it's this. But 10,000 hours, that's a lot of time when you stop and think about it. But I'd much rather have somebody talking to me if I was in trouble for something, an interrogator who'd had more than 10,000 hours under their belt. The more hours they've got, I want the oldest one you got, man. Bring me that person. I don't want some young guy. Yeah, I can bring me some old dude, you know, who can tell, has done it 1,000 times, is going to know whether you're guilty or not. That's the one I'd want.
All right. Now, go ahead. Sorry.
I'll read this one. How do you get a somewhat hyper introverted personality to open up a bit into a normal conversation or interview?
You got to make him know that you know how they feel without saying, I know how you feel. You have to talk like they talk. You have to be like they are. You have to reference things. You have to be familiar with what that is. So you can talk to them in the fashion they're used to hearing. And once you start getting those cues of, oh, I see what's going on here. After talking to them, you can get a pretty good handle on that. Sometimes you can't, but a lot of times you can. Then you can start relating to them easier. I mean, you can start building rapport with them really quickly. That's the key, is building rapport with people like that.
Now, how easy or hard is it to turn it off? Because you talk about you and Greg going out and it's like you have fun doing it. Chase has a description in one of his books where he describes something that's like out of the movie Touch of Evil in the opening scene, where he's just going all the way around the room and he's constantly processing pieces, little bits of information, you know, like Sherlock Holmes or something. And I, you know, in my experience, like when I'm in trial, I have difficulty turning it off. Like I've learned not to communicate with people too much when I'm in trial. There's somebody that's still mad at me from a conversation 18 years ago. But once you're in trial, you're in cross-examination mode, and that's not an easy mode to turn down. And Sean Penn describes method acting that way, that he has to like decompress for 3 or 4 months after he plays a role because he lives that role for that time period. How easy or hard is it to turn it off in like personal life when you're doing this all the time? Or is it not a problem because it's just fun anyway?
Well, I'll give you 2 examples. It's easy to say, yeah, it's easy to turn off. You can turn it off. And of course I do. You can't. It's like you just can't. You'll try. What Chase is talking about is like what we, you know, once you realize how mean people can be and what evil really is, and that a lot of evil people out there, when you walk into a restaurant, you don't sit. You're always looking around. My wife is used to it now. She does it. She's a PI, so she goes down this road a lot. And so if we're in somewhere, I always am looking around. I'm always watching for the person who's dressed a little bit odd, wearing a shirt that's they've got a T-shirt on and shirt over it because maybe they're hiding something. I'm looking for the person who's looking around like I'm looking around. I'm looking for all kinds of things like that to make sure everything's good. And if I see something happening that just doesn't feel right, then my attention goes to that. So you really can't, and sometimes it's uncomfortable. Sometimes you can't turn it off, but most of the around family you can, because you used to be around them and all that. You'll be at a party or something with your friends, your really close friends, and then somebody will say something, and you know, just everything goes ding, 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 everything comes on, and you go, wow. And because one of the things you always say is, wow, really? Tell me more about that. And then my wife always goes, don't. So she, you know, it's one of those, but you can turn it off, but the people closest to you, a lot of times you don't see it. For example, my first wife, she was having an affair and I had no earthly idea. I had no clue whatsoever. Her hair was falling out. She was acting weird and sick and all these things, you know, and always having to leave town and all these things. Totally missed it, you know, and she thought I knew because of my skill set, and she thought I was messing with her. So that's what was making her sick. You know, I was making her hair fall. So it just kept getting weirder. And so finally she said, I'm having an affair. I was like, what are you talking about? You know, and I was goofing around and saying, yeah, me too. What are you, what now? So I totally missed that. know, because somebody that close, you're not looking for that. You know, I'm not the type of person that looks for that. But you go like, step 1 foot outside the door and I'm looking. You know, just think everything comes on. You're like, okay, here we go. Not that I had a traumatic childhood or anything. I understand there's are mean people out there. Not that I'm afraid of them. There's a lot more great people and nice people than there are mean people. Don't get me wrong. But, you know, you always hear those things that say, it was a quiet little town. Nothing like that happens here. You know, I'm looking for that little town. You know, I'm looking for what's going to happen in that little town all around me all the time. You'd never believe it in a place like this. Never happened before. Well, you know, I did. So that's what I'm looking for.
Here, Alex Davy Duke says, question, Scott, I believe it was Ekman said there's about 1 in 15,000 persons that can always detect lies from liars. Have you heard this?
You hear different numbers. And I don't know if he actually said they could always do it. But he talks about how some people are really, really good at it and they miss very little. And he's talking about his micro expressions. Micro expressions are little things people do in their face that will leak something, like I was doing my nose earlier. Or if I were to do this with my mouth, I go, or like I said, I'm looking at myself in the reverse in here. So when your mouth moves really quickly, really, really small movements, then you're saying, oh, okay, that could be they're triggering a smile or they're triggering sadness. You might see something flash real quick on them. Ekman's referring to micro expressions, not lying in general. And that was probably from the TV show where it's TV. So in his books, he does talk about that, but he doesn't say somebody can tell for sure every time because nobody can.
How much have you worked with people that do like handwriting analysis, statement analysis? Because like as soon as you guys did the breakdown of that colonel from Canada, man, the Canadians can get crazy, but that's another story. Yeah. I was like, I got to look at this guy's handwriting analysis because I got into that years ago because I was contesting a government subpoena saying, look, they're really looking for personality traits and behavioral items. They're not looking for the physical movements of the fingers when you study what's really going on in forensic handwriting. So Fourth Amendment issues. But it got me into it because it ended up being very, very productive. Though I learned not to always use it at parties because you might say, oh, this shows this person's a sexual deviant. Turns out to be their husband, you know, not good. Yeah. But that guy's handwriting, that colonel's handwriting was freaky. How much do you guys ever look at that other stuff too or work with people who do that?
I don't put much into that. I mean, I understand the handwriting part. When you're saying, did this person write this or not? Or they might've been angry when they wrote it, or they wrote really fast or really slow. Personality type coming out in handwriting. I've never gone down that road. I never followed that. I've never seen that where I thought that's what was happening because they did this with their L's. It means something. I just never, if you ever saw my writing, it looks like a dentist wrote it with his foot. So I don't know what that means, but it's horrible. You know,
well, it often depends. Like it's interesting. Basically, if there's different zones, I've found it to be useful about a third of the time. But like with the colonel's handwriting, it was screaming issues. It depends on the personality, depends on the individual, depends on the analysis. Like body language analysis. Some of it is not that functional and is projecting and a whole bunch of other stuff. Other stuff will be weirdly revelatory. You know, I mean, like the colonel, he had little eyes and capital eyes and cursifies as I, which is extremely rare. People usually just say, you know, I usually it's a single case, but someone that does that is someone that has serious identity issues, at different points, doesn't know who they are. Kind of guy who, you know, dresses up in women's clothes and breaks in and does some of the things that guy did. So, but yeah, I was just curious.
Yeah, I've never studied that. I've never gone down that road because to me, I was like, how can you do that? And I was so focused on the other angle of it, on the neurological, I guess, side of it. I never went down that road. So I've never gone down there. Never.
It can be fun. It has a lot of unconscious to things. You play around with it like at parties and whatnot, but it's hard to avoid certain things that are, at least in my experience, universal. The FBI's forensic handwriting unit is very, very good. And the things they can pick up on are really quite predictive. It's a fun little side hobby, but for another conversation for another day.
Okay.
All right. And we'll end it on this one. Do you think AI tools will be incorporated in this, which is an interesting question, actually?
Oh, yeah. They already are. They are. They have been.
If they aren't already, actually.
Oh, yeah, they'll get rid of me. I'm like, you know, 4 years from now.
Well, maybe they'll tap your brain into the computer. Elon Musk will, like, put the neurons in there, and you'll be permanently doing it for forever.
Oh, as soon as they can put me on a computer chip, I'm going. I'm out. So just the whole thing, I'm going in. I'll got to talk my wife into it. If she'll do it, I'm going to. I'll go. If she wants, I can't go. She won't let me. But if we can both go, I'm going to the computer. Yeah. Yeah. I think AI is coming.
Robots really substitute for the human experience, I guess, is the big question. Because there's so many areas where they try, but there's certain uniqueness. It's like the human eye. We can't really recreate it with a camera yet. We can create pieces of it, but we can never recreate that whole experience. That's why I used to not take photos when I traveled, because I was like, I can't capture what I'm seeing, the whole experience of what I'm seeing. This is a poor man's version of it. Now, my family members and friends would all be mad at me for not doing it, but I wanted to be able to describe it with words as better, as more revelatory and reflective and representative. So do you think that the skill set you have, some portion of it could be reduced to compute? Can all of it? Or is it something that only a portion of it, at least at this stage, could?
I think a lot of it could be. I think a lot of it will be. You know, there, you always have to have the human part of it in there. But I think a lot of it will be, because, everybody likes to think we're smarter than computers. But when you really get into what that is, AI means so many different things and so many different levels and so many, you know, it's huge to say AI. But when you get down to what you're specifically talking about in those things, yeah, they'll get that figured out. But I think at some point you'll need somebody to turn the dang thing on. So yeah, there'll be people there that have to build it and say, here's how it works, you know. But I think someone not telling the truth, I think just from their voice alone, from the way they talk, the stress in their voice, which we didn't talk about. But
I guess the key is, could a robot induce the revelatory discussion from the suspect or the person being interviewed? That I guess that might be the part that's the hardest part to reproduce. And since if you have that colonel in Canada and he's talking to a robot or a computer, he probably never gets as revealing as he did with that detective.
Oh, is that as an interrogator, as far as that goes, that would be really tough, because you've got to be able to read that person's emotions as to whether or not you can go in and touch them and go, hey man, listen, everything, you know. Or like we saw in Jim Smith, that's that guy's name, and he's actually going to be on our show next week.
Oh, fantastic.
So, we're so excited. We can't.
He could do self-righteous anger very well. That whole, you know, you promised to be honest with me. Oh, yeah. And that was good. That man was skilled. Yeah. That was impressive. All right. That's cool.
Okay. One more question before we do this. Scott, you're going to mention to everyone where they can find you. Do you worry that you have helped convict an innocent person or someone who was guilty of something, but not what they were charged with? And I guess not what they confessed to. Have you ever gotten a false confession, Scott?
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's a whole study in itself. Fascinating study. And that happens quite often. I mean, it happens all the time for, you know, various reasons, you know, but it's fascinating why people do it, and they do it. And yeah, it happens all the time, you know? Yeah. I've had that happen. Yeah. But you got to be able to, once they give it to you, you got to go out and say, you know, look, this guy didn't, he's going to say he did it, didn't do it. So, and then it's another hour conversation.
Okay. Well, we'll save it. We'll do it. So we'll save it. So we have subject matter for another stream. Scott, where can everyone find you?
Bodylanguagetactics.com. That's the best place to get a hold of me.
Okay. And also, when I posted a link to your channel, so everyone knows where to go, but I suspect everyone's already there because of how amazingly interesting and popular it is and has become. So everyone check it out. What's your next subject matter for your show?
It's going to be Jim Smith. That's the interrogator from the Colonel Russell Williams case, because we're just fascinated with it. And Greg got a hold of him on LinkedIn. He's like, yeah, I've watched part of that. I'll come talk to you. We're like, yeah. So you're going to see us like kind of, you know, nerd out and fan out on this guy, because, man, he did such a great job. So, and I don't know, we'll just talk to him about interrogation. It may be the most boring thing we've ever done. Nobody will probably watch it, but you know, we don't care. We're there to goof off with each other and then be serious while we're doing videos. So, I mean, hopefully people watch, but if they don't, yeah, we're not there. We're not there going, oh, people like this. We're there going, let's talk about this. This looks weird.
They can't all be your most popular videos, but there's something for everyone in there. Everybody, I don't know if you can hear a kid screaming like an animal upstairs, but that is my cue to wind things down. Scott, thank you very much. Robert, stick around. We'll say our proper goodbyes. Everyone in the audience, thank you all for coming in. Sunday night stream. And next week we have some good streams. So stick around. Yep. Stay tuned.
And I'll be over at a live chat after party at vivabarneslaw.locals.com.